I believe, and I believe this as a scientist, and is that you perceive the world through a structure of value that is essentially a map of the territory. So when you look out at the world, you think, well, there's the world, that's the objective world. But obviously you don't just see the objective world, because we wouldn't have had to develop science to give us a picture of the objective world if you just saw the objective world. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty damn difficult to formalize an objective picture of the world. So if you don't see the objective world, well, what is it that you see? Well, a lot of what you see, a tremendous amount of what you see, is memory. Like, you don't know that, but your brain uses memory to represent things whenever it can, because seeing the world is unbelievably challenging neurologically. And so we exercise the use of our central vision very selectively. We only look at what's important. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, what's important is what's valuable. Well, you don't know that you're making an unbelievably complex, value-laden decision whenever you look at something. It's happened, like, it's actually the frame through which you see the world. And it's a map. And the reason for that is, well, you have to do things. You have to get from point A to point B. Now, I derive part of this theory in Maps of Meaning from a book called The Neuropsychology of Anxiety by Jeffrey Gray. Gray developed a theory of emotion that's predicated on the idea that, essentially, on the idea that most of your emotions are experienced in relationship to a goal.
Okay.
And so you establish a goal, then movement towards that goal, or evidence that you could move towards that goal, makes you happy, produces positive emotion, whereas evidence that the goal is invalid or that you're blocked in some way produces negative emotion. Mm-hmm. So you lay this map on the world. It has it always has a destination point in mind. There's always a destination point implicit in it or explicit in it. So it works as subtly as this, for example. So if you walk into your room and you want to walk towards something to pick it up, and your room is cluttered because you've been careless, all that clutter manifests itself as an obstacle to your goal and produces negative emotion. And you experience that instantaneously, essentially, and automatically. And so part of the reason, you know, that I encourage people to clean up their rooms, mm-hmm, let's say, mm-hmm, is, well, it's a microcosm of all this. Your room is part of your experience that you have control over. And it's easy to underestimate its significance. But that's a place you can alter. You can set it up for whatever it is that you're doing. Well, what are you doing? Well, that's the first question you have to ask yourself if you're going to set up your room. It's not trivial. It's hard. Genuine ethical virtue is it's the only source of resilience and strength that you have. And it's also the place, as far as I can tell, that the meaning that allows you to set yourself against suffering resides. You know, people talk about life and its meaning, and they say, well, life is meaningless, but people never mean that, because if you're in pain or you're terrified, you're overwhelmed with meaning. It's just not the kind of meaning you want. And it's not a reality you can talk yourself out of easily. And that's particularly true of pain, but it can also be true of anxiety. And so the question is there a reliable source of meaning that you can set against that? And what's its nature, if so? And so here's a way of conceptualizing it to some degree. So I'm currently in a rather remote location in northern Ontario. And one of the advantages to being here is that I can go out on my dock at night and I can look up and see the night sky. And when you see the night sky, when it's pitch black, you are face to face with something as near to the infinite as we can face in a prosaic day-to-day setting. And so there's an experience that goes along with that, and the experience is one of awe and wonder. And awe is a very interesting emotion, let's say. It's unbelievably ancient from a biological perspective. So if you feel awe, your hair might stand up on end. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get that feeling, chills running down your back, say when you're listening to music that you particularly enjoy. And that's a variant of the reflex that prey animals have when they see a predator. Their hair stands on end so that they look bigger. Now, of course, they don't know that. So part of that feeling of awe is tied to our ancient mammalian heritage. It's a variation of the response we had to a predator. We're in the face of we're facing something much greater than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so, but there's more to it if you think it through, because when you face the night sky, for example, or you face something, you confront something that fills you with wonder and awe, there's also a call to action that's sort of implicit in it. And maybe you think, well, the wolf is calling to the rabbit to be better at defending itself in some sense, to be a better rabbit, because otherwise, man, you're going to be eaten by the wolf. And when you look up to the night sky and you feel awe, there's a call there. It's part of that experience to imitate that great thing that you perceive. Now, you might say, well, how can you imitate the infinite cosmos as well? Obviously, that's a very complicated question. But, you know, you're a very complicated thing. And God only knows what it means for you to imitate the infinite when you apprehend it. I mean, that's, in some sense, that's the fundamental question of life. Is how do we adapt ourselves to the infinite complexity that surrounds us? What must we become? Well, you don't merely think that through. And I mean, you don't, I don't, human beings in general don't. We puzzle it out and we use all sorts of information to do that. And some of these more primordial experiences that are outside the domain of strict rationality nonetheless point us in an ethical direction. And the ethic would be, you should and could be more than you are. Well, then the question is, well, how do you bring that to earth? How does that look when you try to embody it day to day? Mm-hmm. Well, I would say these are obviously not my ideas. They're very old ideas. Well, maybe you ally yourself with truth to the degree that you can. Maybe you pursue beauty. Maybe you pursue the love that attaches you appropriately to other people, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and you do that because, well, I think you do it because life is very, very difficult. I was talking to my wife the other day, and she's become very interested in Christianity, and she was talking about a set of mysteries that are part of the Catholic ritual, and one of the mysteries is Christ's bearing of his cross, and someone helps him. And this isn't the I'm not speaking about this religiously. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking about it practically and psychologically. It's a remarkable story because it implies that human existence, like our subjugation to vulnerability, which is exemplified in that story, to be rejected by the crowd, to be betrayed, to be killed, that subjugation is so difficult that even God himself needed help. Mm. And so the question is that, and like I said, I'm not speaking religiously. I'm looking at the story in some sense as a psychologist. It's like, what does that imply? Well, it implies you have to call on, you have to note when you're being called to be more than you are, and you have to attend to that very carefully because life is extraordinarily difficult, and to manage it in a manner that makes it acceptable, or perhaps more than acceptable, you have to be everything you could be. So that's not exactly strength, right? It's way more than that. Strength is a way into it. It's a specific virtue. It's a way into this, into the discussion of what constitutes the ideal.
Often you talk about one way to find meaning is in the journey between who you are and who you could be. But how do you make sure that when deciding like who you could be, that you're not aiming too high?
Right.
Because then potentially you could be disappointed.
Oh, that's so, a good. That's
but
a
how
really...
do you make sure that it's challenging enough to keep you engaged?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's something you encounter practically in a clinical setting all the time. Well, you know, let's say I was dealing with a client, and maybe that was somebody who, say a man, 35 years old, he still lived at home, so he was too dependent. His room is a complete bloody catastrophe. And, you know, he's living like a bratty 13-year-old, and that gets pretty ugly by the time you're 35. You know, and he knew it, and I'm sure his mother knew it, although obviously she put up with it, which was probably her mistake, at least in part. But maybe we decide, well, you know, let's start by cleaning your room. And so as a cognitive behavioral psychologist, you engage in a process called collaborative empiricism. And that's partly to solve the problem that you described is, well, how do we know we set the right goal? Well, I'd say, well, go try it. And just watch yourself like you don't know who you are and come back next week and we'll see how you did. And maybe I remember this one client, he came back and he said, you know, I went and got the vacuum cleaner from the closet, which is something I really never done. And I put that vacuum cleaner in the doorway of my bedroom crossways, so it blocked the doorway. And then I just walked over it for a whole week. And like, he was completely nonplussed at his own intransigence. And look what he did, eh? He was so resentful and so angry that he, instead of vacuuming his damn bedroom like he planned, he just stuck the vacuum in his own way and then martyred himself over it every day for a week. It's like, okay, then we're starting to get somewhere with the whole you living at home thing here. And so, well, that was too high a goal for him. And you say, well, how do you know that? It's like, well, he didn't do it, did he? So then what you do practically is you say, well, how about you bring that vacuum cleaner into your room this week and that's your whole assignment? And just watch what happens when you bring it in. Watch the fantasies that flicker in the back of your mind as you live out your resentment at your therapist for daring to make you bring that vacuum across the threshold of your bedroom. And so if people catch those fantasies, whew, that's quite the bloody nightmare and quite the revelation to themselves, I can tell you, because you have to be one angry person to put a vacuum cleaner in your doorway and walk over it every day for a week. And so then we'd get somewhere. It's like, okay, now we're getting to the bottom of things, you know. And but maybe the next week he'd come back, well, with the fantasies at hand and rather shocked as a consequence, but the vacuum cleaner was then in his room. And so he broke the threshold there. You know, and then maybe we'd have to, maybe all he could do was sort out a drawer or half a drawer, something like that. So what you do is, you know, you pick a target that you think is probably reasonable and you can negotiate that with yourself. What I would do often practically with my clients is I would say, well, your life is not going very well and that's why you're here. I mean, that wasn't a pronouncement on my part. And I would ask them, you know, what problems they were suffering from, what they were suffering from. But I would usually do a pragmatic analysis of the generic quality of their life. And it's not that hard to do. You can do this for yourself. It's part of this self-authoring program that I have online. Well, I'm miserable and I'm anxious and I'm bitter and I'm angry and I'm stuck in my career and I don't seem to be able to get anywhere. And God damn it, life isn't worth living anyways, and so half the time I'm suicidal. It's like, okay, you know, right? Now we've established the problem domain, right? At least somewhat. And then I would say, well, hypothetically, you'd rather that some of that wasn't the case, right? So because we want to establish a goal, what is it you want? More misery or less misery? And usually by the time people had come to therapy, unless they were mandated to do so, which never works, by the way, they wanted things to be better. That's why they were there. You know, now and then you get someone who was there just to, you know, maybe please someone else. But I could usually get beyond that, because if they were willing to come there, there was at least a part of them that was hoping that there was such a thing as up. And then we'd just walk through their life. It's like, okay, well, let's do an assessment. Do you have any friends? How often do you see them? Well, I have six friends, but I only see them once every 6 months. You know, one of them every 6 months. Well, you know, that's pretty low on the friendship hierarchy. So I just file that away as a piece of evidence. Do you have an intimate relationship? Are you as educated as your intelligence would indicate might be useful? Do you have a job? Do you have a career? Or failing that, a job? Right? Because generally people need at least a job and perhaps hopefully a career. How do you regulate your drug and alcohol use? Because that's a major pitfall for people. How do you use your leisure time? How do you take care of yourself mentally and physically? Now, that's not everything about life, right? But if you don't have any of that, well, we have a place to start then, you know, like maybe you should try to make one friend, you know, and there are ways of doing that. So, for example, one of the things that my wife and I used to do when we moved to a new place, which we did fairly often, was we'd pick some local hangout place, restaurant, bar, something like that, and we just go there every week. And until we started to know at least the proprietors, we'd introduce ourselves and we'd make that a routine. And then, you know, you can get to know people. And sometimes with my clients, I would have to, some of them were incredibly not socially skilled, like in ways you just have no idea. Well, maybe some of you do. How? Well, because I don't mean you specifically, although maybe I do, but you certainly may know people like this. I had one client who was literally so socially anxious he could not use a telephone, and so he was just he was absolutely terrified of people. He'd been horribly bullied. He was three quarters deaf. He had obsessive compulsive disorder. He had an intellectual impairment. I mean, this guy had a rough time, man, and he was so terrified of, he could hardly talk to men and women, man. They were so terrifying to him. He just didn't even know literally where to start. Well, sometimes when people are extremely impaired, they don't know anything basic. They have no friends. Why? Well, they introduce themselves like this. What's your name? And then maybe you say it, but they're so preoccupied that they don't hear it. And then they shake hands. So let's shake hands. That's not good. That's not good. You don't remember the name. You're not making eye contact, so you can't see the person's emotional response, and then you're afraid, and that's why you're looking away. And then because you're afraid and you're looking away, you don't pick up the social cues about how to initiate conversation, even if you know how to do that. So then you're awkward, and because you're looking away, you don't listen, and then you can't enter into the flow of conversation. And so we'd practice shaking hands, you know, maybe 20 times till the person could do it and was comfortable with it. And, you know, that's how you start at the bottom of things. I mean, the guy had a lot of obstacles standing in his way. And so we had to find, you know, a place to start. But we would set those seven goals. It's like, well, you know, maybe you could have a friend or two, and maybe you could do something that would educate yourself to some degree. And maybe we can take some steps towards moving you towards a job. With him, I started trying to get him a volunteer job, which you think would be easy, but which is actually, practically, just so you know it, when you're thinking about people struggling at the bottom who are unemployed, so why don't they get a volunteer job, say, to start them in the process? It's bloody well harder to get a volunteer job than a real job. You need a police check for most volunteer positions if they deal with personal care, because people are so afraid of litigation. And for someone who's basically illiterate and also who has extreme social anxiety, the whole police check thing wasn't working. And I sent him to an employment office and they said, well, type up your resume and distribute it. It's like, that's real helpful. He can't type, you know, he's barely literate. He's never used a computer. He doesn't know what a resume is even. It's like, type up your resume and distribute it. Jesus, how pathetic. So one of the things you do if you negotiate with yourself is set a goal and then see if you move towards it. And if you don't, well, maybe it's the wrong goal. Maybe it's too large. Maybe it's too small for you, right? So now it's not engaging you. Maybe you didn't really want to pursue that goal and you're just deluding yourself. And, you know, it's helpful to have someone to talk those things over with. But I would say start from the if you're not doing what you want to do or what you think you should be doing, drop the presumption that you know who you are. and start to negotiate with yourself like you're a stranger who needs to be enticed forward.
People need the opportunity to be good at something. So then you might ask yourself, well, what's the best antidote to the discomfort of life? And you might say, well, it's comfort. And I suppose that's what you act out when you swaddle a baby. But a better antidote is something like adventure to excellence. And that's far better antidote to suffering than the mere absence of suffering. So not to say that the mere absence of suffering, that's not nothing, you know.
Stepping out of that sedation from comforts, difficult though, especially if you've become routinized to it.
Yeah, well, that's the difficulty of maturity. You know, the Freudians said very wisely that the good mother necessarily fails.
What's that mean?
It means she stops providing the comfort that insulates people against the need for adventure.
I heard you say recently that a mother's ability to let her child go out into the world, knowing that they're still vulnerable and that it's now down to them and the world to look after them, that's one of the bravest things that they can do.
It's the female crucifixion.
That's what I meant.
And that's exemplified best in, well, the best portrayal of that I've seen is Michelangelo's Pieta. You know, it's a statue of Mary, and she has Christ's body on her, as an adult, on her lap, and she's broken and destroyed, and you know, she's displaying that. And that's the bravery of a mother to allow that to happen. But not only that, to facilitate it. Facilitate it.
So what about...
Way you go, kid. Way you go. Way you go. Well, why? It's dangerous out there. It's like, yeah, no kidding. It's more dangerous here if you stay with me. By a lot. So you might lose your body out there in the world, but if you stay here, you lose your soul.
There's a classic representation of the feminine in the West, and the classic representation is Mary. And here's one of the representations. It's lovely, and it's derived, at least in part, from the story of Mary and the snake in the Garden of Eden. And so Mary has her foot on a serpent, and she's holding Christ off to the side, like this. Well, that's exactly what mothers have always done. It's a biological portrait of human women, is they hold their infants out of the reach of the terrible serpentine predator. Obviously, that's what we do. Well, that's fine, but adults aren't infants, and neither are children. And if you treat them like they are, you undermine them. You pathologize them. You turn them into old infants. That's an ugly thing. And that's the Freudian nightmare. You know, and this happens in therapy very frequently. I mean, you can be tangled into a terrible relationship with your father. That's often either because he was absent, abusive, or tyrannical, something like that. But the standard pathology with mom is she did everything for you. Well, what's left for you to do? Nothing. Including never leaving. Right. And that's the motivation, you know. For the woman who's nothing but protective mother, there's no role outside of nurturer of infants. Well, you just keep them infants. They'll never leave. They might kill you one night in your sleep, but they'll never leave. It's so comical watching the feminists, postmodernists in particular, rattle on about the absence of gender reality and act out the archetypal devouring mother at exactly the same time. For them, the world is divided into predators and infants. And the predators are evil and need to be stopped, and the infants need to be cared for. Well, that's what the mother does. But adults are not infants. And all you do is destroy them when you treat them that way, especially when they're adolescents and just starting to develop. You know, there's a rule that I attempted to abide by when I had small children, and the rule was,
Don't do anything for your children that they can do themselves. And that's annoying, that rule, because it takes you like 15 seconds to dress a two-year-old, but if you let the two-year-old dress himself, it's like it's 15 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour. You chase them around the house. But if you let them learn to dress themselves, then you don't have to dress them anymore, and they can do it. And you do that with setting the table, and you do that with everything. It's like, no, it's okay, you do that now. Well, I care for you so much, let me do that for you. It's like, I don't care for you at all when I say that. I don't care for you at all. I'm going to stop doing everything I possibly can for you as rapidly as I possibly can. Say, well, that's great. That's how you work in an old age home. Do not do anything for the inhabitants that they can do themselves, because you rob them of the last vestiges of their independence, right? It's what you do when you're a manager. If you're a good manager, you make yourself superfluous by extending autonomy and independence to the people that you manage so that they can take over the whole job. You don't do that by doing everything for people. And you certainly don't do that by dividing the world archetypally and uncritically into predators, those who have more, and victims, infants, those who have nothing, and acting like all you can ever do is protect them. You don't protect, first of all, you can't protect people. You can only make them strong. That's it. You cannot protect them. You can make them strong, and then they can protect themselves.
A woman is extremely bonded with her infant, say between 0 and 9 months, and the infant is utterly helpless. And so complete compassion and the provision of comfort is the only job that matters, and that's really the case. And then the woman has to switch gears to some degree. The mother has to switch gears as the child starts to become more mobile, fundamentally, and more independent. She has to let go of the infant, which is a real grieving process, and she has to start to facilitate this movement towards independence. But that's a hard shift, and so partly the role of the father in that is to be an advocate for the child's independence and to comfort the mother, to let her know that that degree of security provision is no longer necessary, but also to act as an advocate for the child's outgoing desire. And so it's the Oedipal situation is not only the mother, it's also, say, the weak father, but then it's also the child. So you can imagine, because Jung believed that these negotiated agreements were relational. So, you know, you're 6, you're in grade 1, maybe you're feeling a little ill, maybe you're not. Maybe you're playing with being a little ill, and maybe you're playing with exaggerating how ill you are, and your mom comes downstairs and says, you know, you've got a test today at school, maybe you haven't quite prepared for it, maybe you know you should have. And she says, but you know, you seem to have a tummy ache. Maybe you're too sick to go to school. And the kid thinks, maybe I could just stay home, and you know, mom could tuck me in, and I wouldn't have to take that test, and I wouldn't have to confront the world. And he says, yeah, mom, my stomach really hurts. And away we go. And the child has made a choice. And you think, well, that's a catastrophic choice. And you think, well, children shouldn't be held accountable for choices they make at that age. It's like,
that child's soon going to be an adult that's going to make very similar decisions.
The choice has consequences, and to be held accountable for that is to recognize purely that the choice has consequences and that it is a choice. Now, you know, you could say, well, 95% of the blame is to be put on the mother, and maybe that's an overestimate. I think it probably is. But the child could say, Mom, you don't have to worry about me. I'm going to get up and go do this. And that's choice. And that's the right choice. So these are always chicken and egg problems, obviously, but that fleshes out the complexity of the situation. You know, if you're being enticed down a pathological road, you can accept or reject the invitation. Now, some people are better at enticing and some people enforce it more harshly. And, you know, there's all sorts of individual variability in situations like this. But just because you're offered the bait doesn't necessarily mean that you have to take it. So, and I'm not a determinist. I do believe that people have free will, whatever that means. That's a murky subject and it gets complicated the more you look at it. But whatever, it's still a good shorthand way of describing the fact that we seem to be cursed with responsibility for our own destiny, at least to some degree.
If you want to know something about yourself, sit on your bed one night and say to yourself, you got to mean this. Like, you got to be desperate. This is no game, this. It's like, my life is not everything I want it to be, and perhaps it's not everything that I need it to be. And by need, I mean my life is so unbearable that the suffering that's attendant upon that is make me nihilistic, cynical, bitter, resentful, homicidal, genocidal, unable to have a good relationship, prone to punish people for their virtues because of my jealousy, driving the proclivity to see evil everywhere except within my own heart. Like, these are problems, man. And you ask yourself, you sit on the bed and say, okay, man, I'm ready to learn something. Like, what's one thing I'm doing wrong that I know I'm doing wrong that I could fix, that I would fix? It's like, you meditate on that, you'll get an answer. And it won't be one you want, but it'll be the necessary one. You know, and it's often something that will point you to small things. So Carl Jung said, people in the modern world don't see God because they don't look low enough. And so imagine you're in your messy bedroom, you know, and you're sitting on the edge of the bed trying to have an honest dialogue with yourself. And the little voice says, you know, it's pretty disgusting in here. And you think, well, I'm way above such trivial niceties as organizing my room. It's like, well, that's pride. That's arrogance. If you're above organizing what's actually yours, how in the world are you ever going to organize anything else? And so you get on your knees and you think, well, it's time to, you know, take a brush to the toilet. And maybe that's where you start. And so, and that works. Like, that works. You start making those micro improvements, like real micro improvements, real on the ground, actual micro improvements to things you know that are wrong. You'll improve unbelievably rapidly. So when I was doing my clinical work, which I did a lot of career work with my clients, both at a beginner level, I would say, like really a beginner level, with people who had no employment whatsoever, no history of employment, who were undereducated and who lacked every skill you could possibly imagine. So these were people who were really in dire straits, up to people who were operating at the top of their profession, but who could still strategize forward. And so, for example, let's say you're at a dead end in your job. Okay, so I don't find my work meaningful. All right, so that's a problem statement. It's like, well, why not? I find the work I do repetitive and boring and without spirit. I have a bad relationship or a neutral relationship with my boss who doesn't know who I am. I have problems with coworkers. All of that needs to be differentiated, right, and analyzed in detail. So we might say, for example, let's say you believe that you're undervalued at work, and maybe you are. What you need to do is you have something to say, and we would have to figure out what it is that you have to say. But it would be some variant of, I'm bringing more value to the table than I'm being compensated for, and that's demoralizing me. And it's also not good for you, you being my boss, because if I'm actually more valuable than is being recognized, then the fact that you're not valuing me properly means that I will become demoralized, I won't work properly, and you won't get the best out of me. So it's bad for both of us. And if your boss is in principle not amenable to such a discussion, then what you should seriously consider doing is finding another job. Okay, so let's say we're going to set you up for this. Okay, this isn't like next week's enterprise, man. This is your life. So the first thing I would ask is, well, do you have your resume or CV in order? Well, I haven't typed it up for 3 years. Well, what do you think about bringing it up? Well, I'm pretty nervous about that because there's some holes in it. And, you know, I didn't do so well in college and I'm kind of embarrassed about my resume. It's like, okay, bring it in. Let's go through it. Let's Let's at least update it. Let's look where the holes are. Let's look at where the inadequacies are as far as you're concerned, right? This isn't my judgment. It's your judgment. Let's walk through those judgments and see if they're warranted, because maybe you're just too guilty and ashamed and self-conscious and anxious, and you're looking at your resume more critically than someone else would. And maybe there's some holes that you need to rectify. You know, you were two courses away from your BA and you dropped out or something like that. Well, maybe we need 6 months to address that. And at least, even if you can't be fully educated, you could be taking some courses online. And so when you went to a new job interview and they said, what about this hole? You'd say, well, I came to terms with that 6 months ago, and in an effort to rectify it, I'm taking the following courses, and here's my plan for completion. That's a really good answer. And anyone with any sense who's interviewing will accept that as an indication that although you're not perfect, and who is, that you have a good plan and that you've thought it through. Like, that's the kind of answer that in all likelihood will cement your candidacy for the position. Okay, so now you're going to go to your boss. Well, you have to have your CV and your resume in order, and you have to be able to stand on it solidly, and which at least means that you're prepared to address the inadequacies in a credible, realistic, believable, and truthful manner. All right, now what you do is apply for like 10 jobs. You don't have to take them, but maybe you have to go to an interview or two or three or four, and maybe there's a bunch of opportunities out there for you that you didn't even know about. And maybe someone offers you a job. And so now you can go to your boss and say, here's the situation I'm in here at work. Here's my evaluation of the problems in relationship to me. Here's what I could do for you if you gave me a 40% raise and the opportunity to progress, but I'd like to see a plan for that. And I've been looking for other opportunities before conducting this discussion, and I have some. Well, then, if your boss treats you with contempt at that point and doesn't listen, then perhaps he or she is a little more narcissistic than might be optimal, and it's time to find a new job. But this isn't something you do trivially. And so when you're doubtful, say you're trapped, you ask yourself, well, why am I trapped? And that's a hard question, right? Because some of it's your own inadequacy, a lot of it. And all of the part of it that you can deal with is your own inadequacy. So even if it's unfair, you know, even if you're hemmed in for any number of reasons, inappropriate, like ethnically predicated oppression, let's say, or maybe you live it, you're in a workplace that really is sexist in some fundamental sense. Well, that's not good. It's not just, it's not fair, it's not meritorious, all of those things. And maybe you shouldn't be there. But what you can do to begin with is every bloody thing you possibly can do to put yourself in the most virtuous and powerful negotiating position possible. And you have to think like a snake in some sense to do that. You got to get the details right. You have to be prepared to bite, and you have to have your eyes on the prize, so to speak. I'm trying to get a hold of the Disney people at the moment because I want to do a lecture series on Pinocchio, because I think Pinocchio is a brilliant work of art. And if you're a puppet and an actor, and Pinocchio is both at times in that movie, both a puppet and an actor. So why an actor? Like, why is there something wrong with being an actor? Well, the first question is, well, who sets your role? And then the second question is, who's pulling your strings? So you've put on this front that is there to make you popular and sexy and desirable and to mask from yourself your own inadequacies. But that's a role. Well, who wrote it? And for what purpose? And so Jung said, for example, that we all acted out a myth, and whether we knew it or not. And, you know, maybe you're acting out a tragedy. Maybe you're acting out Narcissus. You don't know, because you've put that on yourself in an attempt in some ways to deliver to people what they want, or more accurately, to look as though you're delivering to people what they want. And it's not nothing to do that, right? Because at least you're attempting in some sense to adapt to the social world. Someone who's really infantile and dependent, someone who's never left home, part of their problem is that they haven't crafted a persona. So
You don't want to denigrate it entirely, but it's no substitute for the real thing. And it turns out that not only is what we want from each other the real thing, but that's also the adventure of your life. And so if you aren't truthful, and that means, unfortunately, especially at the beginning, when you start to be truthful, it means deeply coming to terms with your inadequacies in humility. So it's very painful. Without that, you don't have the adventure of your life. You have the role that has been, that you've acquiesced to. And that'll take all the meaning out of your life. Very difficult to calibrate how many units of physiological preparedness you should manifest per unit of threat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because how big's the threat? And the answer is, you don't know. You wake up in the morning and you have an ache in your side. Is that nothing? Or is that the cancer that's going to kill you in 6 months? And it's pretty low probability that it's the latter, but the probability is not zero. So why shouldn't you be panicked out of your mind? And the answer is, some people are. And sometimes they're right. So the calibration of threat, especially when it's associated with novelty, is an impossibly difficult computational problem. We have like 10 different mechanisms to try to solve that. And one of the mechanisms is, well, there's tremendous variability in response. And if you're higher in trait neuroticism, you're going to have the problem you're described all the time. You're going to be doubtful about your competence and the validity of your position. And the only treatment we really know for that is to expose yourself to things that you're afraid of voluntarily and to become braver as a consequence of doing that. But some people have to live with that more than other people.
The thing that I realized was that after a while, if you continue to disprove your imposter syndrome in the real world, you have a challenge, you're adamant that you probably won't or might not or don't deserve to get past it, and then you do. Mm-hmm. After a while, you have to admit to yourself that your imposter syndrome has nothing to do with your capacity and everything to do with your addiction about feeling like an imposter.
And that does change. As people age, generally speaking, they become more agreeable, more conscientious, and lower in negative emotion. And some of that is that adaptation. You see that you survive through various challenges, and then you can review that evidence to yourself, but also the people around you bolster you because they have confidence in you, and so their anxiety doesn't trigger your anxiety, and they'll remind you too, you know, you got this, you've done things in the past.
Such a wealth of data, you know, you've done it so many times.
I think that does help. I mean, it does help. People get more confident as they get older and they accrue experience because of that, but it's subject to that underlying trait variability and sensitivity to negative emotion. I mean, there's been good psychometric analysis of self-esteem scales and neuroticism scales. And they're pretty much the same thing reversed. And so, are you confident in yourself, self-esteem? Do you lack confidence, trait neuroticism? And so, it is harder for some people because it takes more evidence for them to dampen down their response to threat. So, and it's partly because we're all adapted to some degree to the failure of induction, right? Just because something happened multiple times in the past does not mean necessarily that it will happen the next time. And that's it's the farmer and chicken problem, right? Farmer's always feeding the chicken. Chicken thinks the farmer's his best friend, but one day the chicken is dinner. And that's induction. There was a stable pattern in the past. You come to rely on it. But at any time, that axiom can be disproved. And so the fact that we have variability in trait neuroticism is a consequence of the probability of the failure of induction. It's a very difficult problem to solve, how to regulate negative emotion. You know? But I would say that the best way we know is to keep facing challenges voluntarily, pay attention at a rate that works for you, develop your competence. That actually stabilizes the environment around you, so it actually is less predictable and less threatening. Plus, you accrue that evidence, and you get the social support for doing so. That's your best pathway forward.
So there's this idea that Carl Jung developed. He extracted it, I don't know, from where? From some ancient writings that he was familiar with. I believe they were Jewish writings. He said that, classically speaking, traditionally speaking, God was viewed to rule being with two hands, the right hand and left hand, and the right hand was justice, and that was, you're going to get what's coming to you. But the left hand was mercy. And the idea essentially was that the cosmos could not exist without the proper combination of justice and mercy. You should get what's coming to you. But people are fallible and they make mistakes. And so it's reasonable to apply that to yourself. You know, there's an idea that's been developed by psychologists over the last few decades that people are basically narcissistic and that they generally feel that they're better at most things than other people. I don't buy that. I don't think the experimental evidence for that is very strong, and I certainly haven't seen that, for example, in my clinical practice, where I've seen that people are generally far harder on themselves than they are on other people. One example of that, I've written about this in my new book too, is that, you know, if you have a pet that's sick and you take it to the vet and you get medication, you're very likely to give the pet the entire course of medication, to go to the pharmacy to get the prescription filled, to give the pet the medication, to follow it through. But if you are the person who has the problem, yeah, you all laugh because you know the story. It's like a third of you won't even go fill the prescription, and of the remaining two-thirds of you, half won't take it to completion. And you think, well, why are people like that? And I think it's because they know themselves, they have contempt for themselves because of their flaws, and then they come to despise themselves. And I think that's a big mistake. That's lack, that's too much justice and not enough mercy. And you know, Jung wrote about the biblical injunction that you should treat your neighbor as if he were yourself, essentially. But he talked about that as an equation, which was quite interesting. So, because it's often read as something like you should be nice to people, which is not what it means at all. Because first, nice is a very low-end virtue, but it isn't what it means. What it means is that you should treat your neighbor as if he or she is someone that you wish to encourage and develop, but that you should also have exactly the same attitude towards yourself, which is sort of, in some sense, regardless of what your opinion is of yourself, critical, let's say, hypercritical even, which is often the case with people who are anxious or perhaps who are hyperconscientious. You have to put forward to yourself the same sympathy, we could say, that you would extend to someone else that you cared for. That's the thing, is that you have to come to treat yourself as if you're someone that you care for. And I mean that technically. You know, you detach yourself from yourself and you think, okay, well, if I was going to construct a mode of being that was optimal for this person that I happen to be, what would that look like? And that's sort of independent of whether or not you think you deserve it. It's like, maybe you deserve it and maybe you don't. Innocent until proven guilty, that's a pretty good policy. But you should come to lay out a mode of being for yourself that gives you some credit, you know, and that will also help you in your dealings with other people. But it's often very difficult for people to do that to themselves.
Every time you make a status shift, as you move upwards, of course you have imposter syndrome, because when you first make a transition into a new role, you are an imposter because you're a beginner. You don't know what you're doing. And that doesn't mean you're a liar or a fake. And it doesn't mean you should presume more knowledge than you have. It's, what did Nietzsche say? Every great man is an actor of his own ideal. And that feeds into the imposter syndrome in some sense. If you want to move to the next stage, at some point you have to act like you're already there when you're just barely started. And that's not a lie. You know, it's the willingness, it can be, and it can degenerate into a lie, especially if you presume more than you know. But if you move, you know, let's say you move from being an undergraduate to a graduate student. Well, all the other graduate students and the professors know that you're just a beginning graduate student. They're not going to expect as much from you as they would from a more seasoned graduate student. So you have some leeway that's genuine, but you are, you know, the low rung occupier of that role. And of course you're going to feel like you're an imposter if you have any sense, because you're just barely there. You just made the transition. That's okay. You know, that's not a problem. You, first of all, you have to understand that everyone with any sense who isn't narcissistic feels that. And it's actually an indication of your mental health and your competence, as long as that doesn't become crippling. It shouldn't knock you out. I'm such a phony. Well, don't be a phony. That's the first thing. If you're dealing with competent people and you admit your ignorance, the competent people never judge you harshly for that as long as you've been paying attention. So in my classes, for example, people were often afraid to ask questions. And so sometimes I would point to people and ask them if they had a question, especially the quieter types. And they'd be afraid to ask the question because, well, they're revealing their ignorance, and they would assume they're the only person in the room that's that ignorant, but they're not, because if they were paying attention and they had a question, the probability that half the class had that question was really high. It's different if you're not paying attention. And so you can be ignorant, you can be an ignorant newbie, and you can even ask the questions that are necessary to ask in that position and sort of reveal your inadequacy. And as long as you're dealing with competent people, and you've been paying attention, they're just going to answer your questions. And then you only have to be ignorant once. That's the thing about asking a stupid question. You only have to ask it once, then you're no longer stupid. When I went out on tour in 2018, before I went out, I thought I wanted to do this like 100% right, or at least as close to that as I could manage. So I went out and bought some expensive suits, and I spent way more money than I ever thought I'd spend on clothes. And I really felt quite bad about it. You know, I thought maybe it was an extravagance, but I thought, no way, man, I'm going to see if I can nail this dead on. And I'm going to be speaking to, you know, 100,000 people. I'm going to look as sharp as I possibly can. And one of the consequences of that has been that young men in particular come to the lecture tour dressed up in suits, three-piece suits. And the couples come and they're dressed up like they're coming to a wedding. So that's really something. And
why do you think that is? Is it because you set that standard?
Sick acting like kids.
Okay.
You know, our whole culture pushes the idea that teenage life, or even childhood for that matter, but teenage life is some sort of pinnacle, and then everybody dresses down so they look, especially men, they look like overgrown 10-year-olds, and there's something extremely demeaning about that. And so to provide people with the opportunity to dress up in a classic manner and to look like adults, to present themselves in that manner, there's something very attractive about that, because we haven't done that in our culture. That's been, I would say, downplayed in importance certainly since the 1960s.
Who's to blame for that? Because you recall anytime you would fly in an airplane, if you see old school pictures, people were dressed in three-piece suits to go on an airplane. This is in the 60s, I assume. And then now you see someone like Mark Zuckerberg wear a t-shirt to give a speech in front of a TED Talk or something like that. So
well,
who's
some
to blame
of it,
for this dress
some
down?
Of it's just fashion, you know. I mean, fashion moves around, and then it usually drifts from the top down. And so when formality becomes the norm, but that drifts down, say, to the working class, then the upper class thinks, well, we can't do that because that would, you know, associate us with the unfashionable people. And then they dress down. And so then that drifts down the hierarchy. And so there's some of it's just fashion, but a lot of it, too, is this idea that this sort of reflexive rebellious attitude that anything that violates traditional norms, or even anything that's associated with patriarchal oppression and adulthood, is to be eliminated in favor of what's hypothetically a more free individuality. But it's not, because everybody looks the same. I was in Washington 4 or 5 years ago, maybe longer than that. It's probably longer than that, when I first went in the summer. And one of the things that really struck me, all these people wandering around these great monuments, is all the men looked like overgrown 10-year-olds. They looked exactly like their kids, except they were bigger. They looked like they'd been inflated with a bicycle pump. And I thought, this is weird that adults are dressing like children, and not good. And so some of it's fashion, but some of it's also that.
Is it exclusive in America? How about in Canada? What have you seen all over the world with this?
No, I don't think it's exclusive to America. I think it was more noticeable to me in Washington, and I think that's when it really hit me, because Washington is, in some sense, a place of pilgrimage, and people from every class go there, and that's a good thing, and they should, from every economic class. And so it was like a real cross-section of the total population, and that was one of the things that struck me quite bluntly. I talked to my father about this years ago,
because he always wore a suit when he was a teacher. He's still alive. He's a teacher. And he always wore a suit. And I asked him why one day. And he said, because it was his way of showing respect for the students. And I mean, I'm not saying that everyone who doesn't dress in the suit is being disrespectful, but there's something about outfitting yourself for the task at hand. And there's also something about attempting to put some effort into putting your best foot forward. And I don't really buy the it takes more time in the morning argument. It takes a bit more time, but once you, before I went on this tour, I went through all my clothing and I tossed out everything that didn't fit, and which included a number of suits that were old, and I had to organize them, and that took about a day to get my closet in order. I started buying nice clothes, let's say, this year, really. I had some decent suits before that. I did some research online to find out who good suit manufacturers were. You can look that up. But before this tour, I went and talked to a good tailor, expensive place. I felt terrible spending so much money on clothing. But I felt that if I was going to go talk to, it's been 200,000 people, that I was going to do it right, and I was going to invest in some decent clothes. And even though it hurt my cheap Northern Alberta soul to do it, it was definitely worth it. So you go talk to someone who knows what they're doing. Go talk to an actual tailor, and you can do some research online. There's lots of resources online that are devoted to helping men figure out how to dress. Three-piece suits look really good. I've got them tailored and fitted, so they're not bespoke suits. They're off the rack, but they've been tailored, and that makes a big difference. All the subtle things that tailors do, they tuck it in around the waist, they cut it to your body, all of those things help. It's really good to have a good pair of shoes, a couple of nice ties. I learned how to tie a full Windsor knot recently, and that actually helps. You don't want your tie to look too skinny. Lots of people have been dressing up to come to my talk, so it's nice to see a lot of young men come well-dressed, often in three-piece suits, but not always, and it's really good to see them dressed like grown-ups. I think that's a real plus. I had a rule that I didn't write in 12 rules, which was dress like the person you want to be. I kind of took that from Nietzsche, because Nietzsche said, every great man is an actor of his own ideal. It's a very nice aphorism, and basically what it meant was that sometimes you have to act out what you want to be before you become it. You have to pretend. It's not a lie. It's really a pretense, like children pretend to be a father before they grow up and become a father. It's a form of practice. And so tip one might be figure out who you want to be. Tip two might be, well, then dress like that person. That's a good start. And because I think if you want to become who you want to be, then no detail is too small to overlook. And certainly it isn't exactly that people judge you by your clothes, although they do to some degree. It's that if whatever you can have going for you, you might as well have going for you. That's how it looks to me. And certainly my experience has been that the response to my improved wardrobe has indicated that the investment was clearly worth it, indisputably and clearly worth it. And it's nice to be dressed sharply to go in front of an audience. It's a sign of respect to the audience. There's other ways of showing respect to an audience, but that's certainly one. And so it's been extraordinarily worthwhile. I would say if you're going for a job interview, if you're at any critical point in your life, then you should dress the part, because you want to do everything you can to tip the scales in, not in your favor exactly, but in favor of having the right thing happen. Physical attractiveness is extensively studied in departments of psychology. How big of a determinant of success is it apart from IQ or any of the other big five traits? That's tough one, because physical attractiveness is a very complex trait. It's also, for example, it's a marker of health. And of course, health is a prerequisite for success. So we know that that people who are physically attractive, though, are given the benefit of doubt by other people. They benefit from the positive halo effect. And the positive halo effect is the propensity of people to assume good things about someone if there is one outstanding thing about them that's easily evident, that's good. And so if you stand up straight with your shoulders back, so that's rule one in 12 rules for life, then people are going to see you as more attractive. If you're symmetrical, you're more attractive. If you're thin but not too thin, you're more attractive. Well, and then there's like good skin and good teeth and good hair and all of those things, and proper proportions and youth, and there's a whole slew of things that feed into that. If you are characterized by a plethora of those features, then people are also going to assume that you're more competent and more worth having around, let's say. But the problem is that you are. So separating out the attractiveness from the things the attractiveness is correlated with is very hard. That's why you have to do multivariate analysis. That's multivariable analysis in any complex social science, because a lot of these traits overlap. So, but you know, you can there's some things you can do about that. Postural adjustment is helpful. To work out with weights, that's extraordinarily helpful. That improves your posture and makes you more confident, and you can dress reasonably well and intelligently, and all of those things to help yourself capitalize on whatever attractiveness you can muster.
So Zazu, the eyes of the king, comes to check out the king, and that's Mufasa. Yeah, and he's a very regal-looking person, lion, and he stands up straight and tall, and that means that he's high in serotonin, because serotonin governs postural flexion, and if you're dominant and near the top of hierarchies, you tend to expand so that you look bigger than you could if you shrunk down. And so if you're low dominant person, you wander around like this so that you look small and weak, and you don't pose a threat to anybody. But if you're at the top, you expand yourself so that you can command the space. And that's why he has that particular kind of regal posture. And if you look at his facial expression, you see that it's quite severe. He's capable of kindness, but he's also harsh and judgmental. And that's what society is like. That's what the superego is like. And what that means is that he's integrated his aggression. And I've seen this happen in my clinical clients when they come in and they're too agreeable. They look like Simba looks later in the movie when he's an adolescent, and he's sort of like a deer in the headlights. Everything is coming in and nothing is coming out. But when the person integrates their shadow and gets the aggressive part of themselves integrated into their personality, their faces harden. And if you look at people, you can tell, because the people who are too agreeable look childlike and innocent, and the people who, well, a hyper-aggressive person will look, you know, mean and cruel. But I've seen people's face change in the course of therapy. Men and women. So, and what happens is they start to look more mature, and it's more like they're judging the world as well as interacting with it properly once they integrate that more disagreeable part of them. It's very, very necessary, and that's part of the incorporation of the Jungian shadow.